What we're going to do now is skip ahead a little more than 10 years. Now, recall we began with a section of Radio Free America program number 2 from May of 1984, then Uncle Sam and the Swastika, the original broadcast from May 23rd, 1980. We are now going to hear an update from, to Uncle Sam and the Swastika from August of 1990, more than 10 years later. Today is August 12th, 1990, and I'm going to make an addendum to Uncle Sam and the Swastika. By way of introduction, I'm going to begin by reading a short section from The Californian magazine. Research credit on this, by the way, goes to a listener. And in The Californian magazine from October of 1961, there's a section here talking about a response to an article that they did talking about the reinstitution of Nazism and or Nazi officials and the Nazi structure in West Germany following the conclusion of World War II. That is documented at great length in Radio Free America program number 2, available from archives on audio. Now, reading from the Californian magazine from October of 1961, more than 2 years before President Kennedy was killed, we find the following. It's entitled, Nazis Mad at Us. Following publication of the Californian's material on Nazism in West Germany, a crudely printed poster came through the mail with the following words in red and blue ink. We promise. Trotz Judenneid und Hass Geschirr ein geeintes Deutschland. The translation of this is, we promise, in spite of the envy by Jews and cries of hatred, a unified Germany. It was accompanied by an ad for a book glorifying the SS. Well, now in August of 1990, a unified Germany has indeed taken place, and in a footnote to the dire warning sounded at the end of Uncle Sam and the Swastika, by the way, we echoed James Stewart Martin's words from 1950, we echoed those words in 1980, and now in 1990 we find a very, very chilling development. One of the major topics of discussion in Uncle Sam and the Swastika was the IG Farben Company, that is short for Interessengemeinschaft Farben Industry. That was the German dyestuffs cartel, the chemical cartel, which provided the backbone of German industrial production. It was instrumental in the rise of Hitler, and the member companies remained in place, as did the Shell Company after World War II. In addition to the Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast, we spoke about the IG Farben cartel and Radio Free America number 1, Radio Free America number 2. We discussed it at considerable length in a miscellaneous archive show called South Africa, the Third Reich and the Bomb, documenting connections between the IG, the West German nuclear industry, and in turn connections between the South African nuclear industry and that of West Germany. And we also touched on IG Farben and Radio Free America program number 17, the end of the first broadcast in the five-part series about the shooting of the Pope, specifically talking about Deutsche Bank chairman Hermann Abbe's role in straightening out the Vatican banking scandals. He was selected by Carol Wojtyla, who served as a guest laborer in one of the concentration camps surrounding the Auschwitz concentration camp, Hermann Abbe being a member of the board of directors of IG Farben, who helped to put forth the venture capital for... Actually, I don't know if he was a director of IG Farben. I believe he was. He certainly put forth the venture capital for building the Monowitz concentration camp, which used slave labor from Auschwitz. That's documented in Radio Free America 17. Also in Radio Free America number 24, we spoke about the role of the Bayer Company, one of the members of the IG, in developing first heroin, which was designed, ironically enough, as a cure for morphine addiction. They later designed what was first known as Dolefine, named in honor of Adolf Hitler, a synthetic narcotic developed to treat casualties during World War II that later became known as methadone, now used, of course, to treat heroin addiction. IG Farben is one of the most important, if not the most important, industrial concerns in the entire world. And like Germany, it is coming back. And research credit on the following, and this is a chilling footnote here in August of 1990 to the warning sounded by James Stewart Martin in 1950, which we echoed 10 years ago in Uncle Sam and the Swastika in May of 1980. Research credit on this goes to a listener. This is from the Sunday Times of London from July 29th of 1990. It's by Ian Jenkins, I-A-I-N, Jenkins, from Paris. and it's headlined, London Financiers Revive Jewish Gas Chamber Firm. Once again, London Financiers Revive Jewish Gas Chamber Firm. It reads as follows. S.G. Warburg, the City of London Merchant Bank, founded by emigre German Jews, has bought a significant stake in I.G. Farben, a German company the world thought had been killed off for its role in the Jewish Holocaust. Farben, which patented and manufactured the Zyklon B gas used to murder millions of Jews in the gas chambers and ran a slave labor camp near Auschwitz, is rising like a phoenix from its own ashes. For 40 years, the company has been nothing more than a dormant shell, its only task to compensate victims of its slave camp. But the destruction of the Berlin Wall has presented it with the chance of claiming back its huge industrial empire in East Germany and turning itself into a speculative vehicle. The possible resurrection of a name that is synonymous with the Holocaust has sent a shiver of disquiet through Jews throughout the world who thought the company had been buried forever. Eric Moonman, M-O-O-N-M-A-N, or Eric Moonman, senior vice president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews, said, quote, "This will cause considerable upset among Jews, not just in Britain, but throughout Europe," unquote. Ben Helsgott, H-E-L-S-G-O-T-T, a survivor of Buchenwald concentration camp and chairman of the Yad Vashem Trust, which teaches about the Holocaust, said Farben's name was forever associated with death. Again quoting, "I could not invest in this company even if it was the best bargain on earth," unquote, he said. It has, however, attracted the speculative interest of the City of London. Mercury Asset Management, the fund management arm of S.G. Warburg, Fidelity, the pensions group, and Morgan Grenfell, the merchant bank owned by Germany's Deutsche Bank, are among the British institutions that have bought into Farben recently. Other city institutions have done the same, and Farben's shares have risen from 20 Deutschmarks to 30 Deutschmarks. German brokers believe that city firms now own 40% of the company. None of the firms wanted its dealings publicized, but one shareholder said, quote, "We don't blacklist companies on the basis of what they did 30 or 40 years ago," unquote. Farben was the biggest industrial company in the world when the Second World War broke out and gave huge support to the Nazi war effort. It built a synthetic oil and rubber plant and had its own concentration camp staffed by the SS near Auschwitz, where slave laborers worked amid the smell of burning human flesh. An estimated 25,000 people, mainly Jews, died there. After the war, 23 of Farben's directors were tried at Nuremberg for war crimes. 11 were acquitted, and the rest sentenced to between 18 months and 8 years in jail. The Allies then broke up Farben. Bayer, BASF, Hext, and Agfa were stripped out of the company, leaving a property and investment shell with assets of about £150 million. Its job was to compensate its Jewish slave laborers and then to liquidate itself. So far, it has paid $10 million in compensation, but there have been no recent claims. Farben, meanwhile, shows no signs of winding itself up. The other half of Farben's German assets were in the East and were confiscated without compensation by the Soviet-backed communist regime. Those assets, then worth £750 million, could have a current value of £2 billion. Quote, "We have already started to put claims in for these assets," says Carl Ehlerding, E-H-L-E-R-D-I-N-G, a director and one of the largest shareholders in Farben. In anticipation of this windfall, UK institutions started the speculative run on Farben's share price when a 20% block was bought by two leading city firms, apparently Mercury and Fidelity. And it credits additional reporting by Ian Burrell, B-I-R-R-E-L-L, and Helen Davidson. It's interesting, too, that the Farben, although obviously, as we've talked about in the past, the member companies of the IG remained in place. To that extent, the breakup of IG Farben was simply a farce, kind of like the alleged breakup of the Standard Oil Trust, although technically the old Standard Oil Trust in the United States was broken up. It remained in the hands of its ownership. Instead of Standard Oil, you had Mobil, which is Standard Oil of New York, originally Saucony Vacuum, then Saucony Mobil, Saucony standing for Standard Oil Company of New York. Exxon used to be S-O-E-S-S-O, or S-O, for Standard Oil. Chevron is Standard of California. Amoco is Standard of Indiana. Sohio is Standard of Ohio. All of those continue to be owned, although they're publicly traded. The Rockefellers own a controlling interest. The same thing basically happened with IG Farben. We took a look at the alleged breakup of IG Farben in Radio Free America program number 2. It's interesting that the shell firm remained in place with assets of £150 million to pay out compensations to the victims of its criminal activities during World War II. Only £10 million were paid out, and apparently, according to this article, no recent claims have been filed. And again, I want to apologize for the somewhat rough reading here. There are a couple of editorial mistakes, plus, again, I've been reading for almost 4 hours here. So that basically accounts for the bumpiness here. However, the real bumpiness is the fact that the IG has come back. It's back, and it is no longer safe to go in the water. Those people writing in 1961 made good on their promise. And as William Faulkner noted, the past is never dead and buried. It isn't even past. And it's worth noting that only by understanding the past can we understand the present. Reviewing from Propaganda Review, spring of 1989, interestingly enough, in an article called Hitler's Last Laugh, there's a section here by Martin Lee, a well-known political researcher whose work we've used in the past, talking about a review of Blowback, the landmark book by Christopher Simpson. There's a little sidebar here called Cold War Habits Die Hard. The publication of Blowback showed once again that Cold War habits die hard at certain media. Although it was generally well received by reviewers, New York Times correspondent Serge Schmemann, S-C-H-M-E-M-A-N-N, belittled the book in the Times Sunday Book Review section. Without contesting Simpson's documentation, Schmemann accused Blowback of, quote, blurring the distinction between the means and the end, unquote, and, quote, smearing anti-communism with the taint of Nazism, unquote. Missing from Schmemann's review is a pertinent bit of biographical data. His father, the Reverend Alexander Schmemann, was deeply implicated in some of the CIA propaganda operations dissected and criticized at length by Simpson. An Orthodox Christian theologian and right-wing extremist, Father Schmemann gave weekly sermons on the CIA's radio liberation for more than 30 years. So, again, the past is never dead. It isn't even past. And apparently the New York Times, same people who published the Warren Report, do not want you to understand that past. If you understand the past, you can understand the present. If you don't understand the past, you cannot understand the present. As I've said so often, if you don't study history, the world is a mystery. Read or bleed, learn or burn. And that concludes an addendum to the original Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast, that from August 12th of 1990. Again, we are reviewing the restoration of the cartels and the basic corporate reality of Germany after World War II, despite the promises made by the Allied nations, the Western Allied nations, and this by way of taking a look at what was going on in Germany during the period of time that the liberation theory was being projected into the United States. Again, in order to fully understand how the U.S. lost the Second World War, and I in no way mean that figuratively, we have to understand Germany, and just as I stressed the importance of understanding the milieu in the United States through which the Galen Organization operated, the powerful economic, political, and military forces that interacted with it, it is, by the same token, vital for the working hypothesis being presented here, actually the history being presented here, that we understand the powerful corporate and political and military forces, national security forces, that were coming to the fore in Germany at the same time, and with which the Galen Organization operated. Again, bear in mind that the Galen Organization was a Third Reich military institution which functioned continually throughout the Third Reich, throughout its tenure with the CIA and NATO, and even after it was installed as the West German Intelligence Service, the BND, it continued to be a main source, the primary source of information for the CIA and other U.S. intelligence agencies on the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. It is an organization whose history could be said perhaps to be unique in the history of the human race, and as we are examining what is going on in Germany, bear in mind that it served as literally a Trojan horse inside of the United States. In the weeks to come, we will be examining what was going on in Germany. You will get a hint of that. This evening, we will go into some of the same information at greater length in weeks to come. We are going to jump back again to Radio Free America program number 2, done in May of 1984. And having looked at the restoration of the corporate economic structure in Germany, the corporate structure that underlay the Third Reich during World War II, or prior to and during World War II, that corporate structure which intersected in a major way with the American corporate structure, the corporate structure that representatives of which were negotiating with American representatives, notably Alan Dulles, of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis that we looked at in the first two Radio Free America shows in Uncle Sam and the Swastika and Uncle Sam and Il Duce about American support for Mussolini. They set up the Christian West concept, a Third Reich survival concept to blend the U.S. and Britain and France with Germany in a Hitlerless Reich, i.e. Germany, and to have Germany as the keystone for an anti-Soviet alliance. That was the seed concept for NATO, as we've seen. Whether or not it was actually agreed to during the war, it was certainly being negotiated, and it certainly was quite obviously the seed concept for NATO. What we're going to look at now is the political leadership of the, quote, new Germany, and as we will see, it was indeed a Hitlerless Reich. This is something that I will be exploring at greater length in installments of RFA 37 to come. Now, two main names we're going to be looking at here are Konrad Adenauer, Der Alte, the first chancellor of the Federal Republic of Germany, and his Eminence Gries, his Secretary of State, the man who was viewed as the power behind the throne, a man named Hans Globke, who, as we will see, was the individual who drew up the law for the protection of the German blood. That was the legal precedent, the legal statute under which all of the Nazi extermination programs took place against their, quote, racial enemies, unquote. And note that it was Globke who was in charge of supervising the Galen organization. We will be coming back to that because this is the individual to whom Galen reported under the auspices of the Federal Republic of Germany, and bear in mind that at the same time that it was functioning as the BND, the Galen Organization, a Third Reich military and intelligence institution which functioned continually on into the post-war period, bear in mind that the Galen Organization continued to provide the U.S. with most of its intelligence on the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, even in its final incarnation as the BND. Recall also that one of the conditions of Galen's agreement with the Americans was that when German and American interests conflicted, it would be understood that the Galen Organization would operate on behalf of German interests. Well, of course, from the standpoint of the Third Reich, and the Galen Organization was nothing if not an extension of the Third Reich and a projection of it into American society, or in some cases directly, in some cases indirectly via its effects. Bear in mind that the Third Reich's interests did not coincide with America's at all, so therefore German and American interests would have been perceived as conflicting from the get-go for Galen. Bear in mind also NSC 68, a document drawn up under the Truman administration, which had its fruition under the Reagan and Bush administrations, that at some point, I think we can assume that there was a similar BND or German government document dealing with the United States, just as the basic outlines of policy that were delineated in NSC 68 operated for decades. Now, originally under a Democratic administration, they came to fruition under the most reactionary of all Republican administrations. Just so I think we can assume at some point a document was drawn up for the long-term policy of Germany, the, quote, new, unquote, Germany, vis-a-vis the United States. When? I don't know, but it's a pretty good bet that at some point such a document was drawn up, and I rather suspect that what we're seeing now is the culmination, the coming to fruition of that document as well. But we're going to go back to Radio Free America number 2 from May of 1984, and we're going to hear a little bit about the political leadership of the, quote, new Germany, unquote. We will be coming back to this at greater length in installments to come. Now, one of the interesting things about the recent post-war, about the early post-war period that people are not aware of, is the fact that just as the Nazi industrial structure was reinstituted in Germany, and this is going to come as a great surprise to a lot of people, I suspect, the Nazi political leadership, to an amazing extent, was returned to power in Germany. And although the post-war German leadership has been portrayed as very unsullied and non-Nazi, this is not, in fact, the case. And, in fact, the Nazi connections of the German leadership touch even on Konrad Adenauer, the first German head of state, nicknamed Der Alte.
Indeed. And we're going to read here from a section of a book called The Bormann Brotherhood by William Stevenson. This is a Bantam book in paperback, copyright 1974.
Keep in mind that William Stevenson was a former British intelligence agent and specifically worked with a special operations executive, which conducted covert operations on the European mainland during the war. So he was an actual veteran of the struggle against the Nazis. Also, his name is Stevenson. That's worth keeping in mind because there's also another very, very famous British intelligence agent named William Stevenson, but his name is Stephenson, and he's the very well-known Intrepid. This is a different fellow, though.
Okay, now what he is talking about, William Stevenson is talking about here, is a quote that Konrad Adenauer made in 1963. Now, Konrad Adenauer was Chancellor of West Germany from 1949 to 1963, and basically told people all along that he was an anti-Nazi resistance hero, et cetera, et cetera. And the reaction Stevenson is having in the book here is to a comment that that Adenauer made in 1963 that, quote, he was always an opponent of the Nazis. And Stevenson writes as follows: I remembered a letter published in East Germany, later authenticated by the Chancellor, meaning Adenauer admitted to writing this letter, and written originally on August 10, 1934. It was a begging letter from Adenauer to the Prussian and Reich Minister of the Interior, asking for payment of his pension as Lord Mayor of Cologne. In other words, this was being written during the time that the Third Reich was in power. The pension was restored, and it was still being paid him at war's end, when he cultivated his own garden with French slave laborers. The 10-page letter was an attempt to prove that he had always been friendly to the Nazi Party. Quote, I have always treated it in an absolutely correct manner, and in so doing I found myself at loggerheads with ministerial directives. For years, contrary to the decrees of the Prussian Ministry of the Interior, I made available to the party the municipal sports ground and allowed the party to hoist its swastika flag. I urged that municipal advertising should be given to the Nazi Party newspaper in Cologne, the Westdeutschen Beobachter. Anyway, the letter goes on and on. Basically, Adenauer's whole point is he's writing to the Reich ministers, I have always been the Nazis' best friend, you know, when I was the mayor of Cologne. How could you, you know, not give me my pension? Then, of course, after the war, he turns around and says, I was always a firm opponent of the Nazis. Now, this in and of itself is not evidence of anything in particular, other than the fact that Adenauer is double-dealing and hypocritical. However, when we're talking about the issue of failed denazification, we're talking about some hard facts about some rather unpleasant people.
It's also worth, very significant there is the passage that his garden was maintained with French slave laborers. Now, under Third Reich policy, you didn't get your own slave laborers unless you worked very closely with the Nazi. I mean, not everybody got slaves. If he had slaves, whether or not he was a member of the Nazi Party, he worked with the Reich to execute Third Reich policy. And that's an important point. You just didn't get slave laborers. That means he has to, if not joining the Nazi Party, and there's no record that he ever did, he certainly worked with them and was considered a political ally. That point is key here. Now, we're going to begin reading to you from an excellent book called The New Germany and the Old Nazis. That book was published by Random House, copyrighted 1961, the hardcover edition by Random House, and it's authored by a man named T.H. Tettens, last name T.E.T.E.N.S. I'm going to read you a little bit about his background here. From the back cover of the book, T.H. Tettens, a leading expert on German geopolitics, was born in Berlin and worked during the 1920s in Germany as an economist and newspaper editor. For more than 30 years, he has studied the pan-German movement, the Nazi Party, and the strategic theories of German geopolitics. When Hitler came to power, Mr. Tettens was put in a concentration camp. He escaped to Switzerland in 1934. There, in pamphlet and newspaper articles, he foretold the coming German assault on Europe. In 1938, Mr. Tettens came to the United States and began research on German problems for government agencies and private organizations. From 1946 to 1947, he served with the U.S. War Crimes Commission in Washington. Okay, so that is the background concerning Mr. Tettens. Now,
from his book, The New Germany and the Old Nazis, reading as follows. Now, keep in mind that Konrad Adenauer had obviously worked very closely with the Third Reich. He wouldn't have gotten his French slave laborers, and he wrote a letter that we just saw talking all about how, yeah, I'm working with you guys, you know, I think you're great stuff. Now, keep in mind that two of his top officials were a guy named Herbert Blankenhorn, we're not going to talk about him here, and a guy named Hans Globke. Hans Globke, last name G-L-O-B-K-E, was the first Secretary of State of the Third Reich and was one of the most powerful people in Konrad Adenauer's government, sort of nominally the number two man, but according to many authorities, as we're going to see here, he was the number one man in the Third Reich. Okay, Hans Globke was the first Secretary of State under Der Alte, under Konrad Adenauer. Reading now from T.H. Tetten's The New Germany and the Old Nazis. Under the Nazi regime, Hans Globke served as the top official in the Office for Jewish Affairs in the Ministry of the Interior. It was here that the infamous Nuremberg Laws for the Protection of the German Blood were first drafted. The man who signed the racial laws against the Jews, Interior Minister Dr. Wilhelm Frick, last name F-R-I-C-K, was sentenced to death by the International Court in Nuremberg and hanged on October 16, 1946. And the one directly involved with the formulation of these laws was Dr. Hans Globke. It was he who drafted the text of Hitler's race law and who wrote the notorious commentary, unquote, interpreting this Nuremberg law, which paved the way for the extermination of millions of human beings. When the Nazis decided to carry out the mass liquidation of European Jews, Dr. Globke's direct superior, Ministerial Counsel Bernard Lösner, L-O-E-S-N-E-R, himself a party member, had scruples of conscience and resigned from office. His post was taken over by Dr. Hans Globke. As chief legal advisor and head of the Office of Jewish Affairs, Dr. Globke thus became a direct participant in the gigantic venture to make Germany Judenrein, or Jew-free, of course. In applying the racial laws, Dr. Globke worked hand-in-hand with the main security office, the headquarters of the SS murder organization. That is the aforementioned RSHA, the Reich Sicherheitshauptamt, that we're going to come back to later. Returning now to the text of T.H. Tetten's The New German and the Old Nazis. Der Spiegel of September 28, 1960, reported a case which reveals that Dr. Globke had direct dealings with the SS Colonel Adolf Eichmann. More than that, the evidence shows that Dr. Globke was a key administrator in The Final Solution, unquote, the master plan for the extermination of the Jews. The article in Der Spiegel quoted the testimony of a Wehrmacht officer, Max Merten, M-E-R-T-E-N, who together with Eichmann suggested in 1943 that 20,000 Jews in Macedonia, that's in Greece, marked for the gas chambers in Auschwitz should be released and shipped to Palestine. It was obviously not a feeling of humanity, but rather a personal greed for money, as well as a shortage of transportation facilities to the concentration camps that motivated both Nazis to make this suggestion. According to the story in Der Spiegel, Merten and Eichmann reached Dr. Globke and tried to obtain permission from the Office of Jewish Affairs for the release of the prisoners. Their efforts were in vain. Dr. Globke insisted on the strict execution of the Führer's order. That sealed the fate of the 20,000 Jews who were then shipped in cattle cars to Auschwitz. Why Dr. Adenauer could not find another man capable of setting up a true democratic civil service has never been explained. Whatever lies behind this mystery, the fact is that Dr. Hans Globke, who faithfully served the Nazi hierarchy, became one of the most powerful men in the Federal Republic. Recouping a little bit of what Tetens has relayed here, Hans Globke was not only head of the Office of Jewish Affairs, he drew up the Nazi racial law, the law for the protection of the German blood, which provided the legal basis for the extermination not only of the Jews, but of Gypsies and many other ethnic groups as well. Keep that in mind as you hear how powerful he became in the new Germany, quote-unquote.
Yes, bear in mind also that the man who signed those particular regulations was hanged, and that the man who drew them up wound up to become basically second in command of the West German Republic. Okay, reading further from T.H. Tetten's The New Germany and the Old Nazis, it says, and this is around the 1960s, early 1960s this was written, the German press has called Dr. Globke quote, the gray eminence, the power behind the throne, and the spider. Die Welt of October 30th, 1955, which is a German newspaper, described Dr. Globke as, quote, the second in command in the control tower of the German ship of state, unquote. According to Die Welt, Dr. Globke is, quote, the only man who has access to Adenauer at all times or who can call the Chancellor at any hour. The paper adds, quote, Globke's political power rests entirely on the confidence which emanates from his chief and on his domination over the official apparatus, which must be regarded as his exclusive handiwork. Bearing in mind that at this time, Konrad Adenauer was in his 70s, his late 70s, I believe, at that point, was called Der Alte, or the old man. Dr. Globke being the only man who's allowed to wake Adenauer up, we might say that he was, in fact, somewhat analogous to Ed Meese in the West German government.
Read that last sentence for them again. That one goes by so quickly. That's a really important sentence there.
Indeed. Globke's political power, this is according to Die Welt, rests entirely on the confidence which emanates from his chief and on his domination over the official apparatus, which must be regarded as his exclusive handiwork. And as I read the next section, you're going to find out part of what that official apparatus contains. Skipping on down. The result of Dr. Globke's clever manipulations is that as chief assistant to Dr. Adenauer, he makes decisions about a great many affairs in the federal government. A full-page article in the Deutsche Zeitung of June 11, 1958, explained how Dr. Globke is able to wield rigid control over every ministry. The various government departments have to submit monthly reports about their activities and plans, which all end up on Globke's desk. According to this analysis, no minister can make an important decision without the approval of Dr. Globke. It is the secret Secretary of State who convenes cabinet meetings and determines their agenda. The Deutsche Zeitung described Globke as the head of a huge staff, a super ministry, led by 36 senior officials, which constitutes the hub of the entire government machinery. It is Globke who decides what part of the incoming mail reaches the Chancellor. Nominations for appointments to high positions in all ministries are made by Dr. Globke. The result is that every ministry is run either by dependable friends or loyal servants of Dr. Globke. The Christian Science Monitor has stated that this concentration of government power in the hands of a single man has made observers, quote, bitterly complain that Dr. Globke often has had more authority than cabinet ministers, unquote. The New York Times correspondent Sidney Grusin gave the following appraisal. Quote, as State Secretary of the Chancellery, Dr. Globke is acknowledged to be one of the most influential men in West Germany. He runs the Chancellor's office, and nearly all papers for the Chancellor must first go through his hands. Ironically, the one-time servant of the Nazi regime today has full control over the Office for the Protection of the Constitution. Also, under Globke's direct authority, is the operation of a super-secret organization headed by Hitler's former spy chief, Lieutenant General Reinhard Galen.
Worth noting now again, not only did Galen work for the CIA, but eventually his organization became the official NATO intelligence organization, and after that, the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the West German CIA, which, as we've seen, was directly under Globke's control. So Galen, Sieks, Augsburg, Akmatelli, and the whole gang working with under the supervision of Globke.
And we're going to continue with Radio Free America program number 2, an installment of that in this installment of Radio Free America number 37. We will come back at much greater length to not only the top political leadership of the Federal Republic of Germany, but also to the civil service and some of the not-so-visible political leadership in installments to come. Now, we're going to continue with Radio Free America number 2 from May of 1984. And for those of you who are real veterans of the program and are wondering, well, gee, why are we going into all this old material? You will hear, I think, this section of Radio Free America number 2 in an entirely new way. What we're going to take a look at is the German government policy towards ex-Belé, German nationals under some of the territories, who had been in some of the territories in the east that had been occupied by the Third Reich and were then expelled to the Federal Republic. Now, the main names you're going to want to pay attention here are those of Konrad Adenauer, the Chancellor of Germany. They take note of the name of Werner Naumann and the Naumann coup of 1953. We're going to come back to that. It's a very
obscure, a relatively obscure but very important aspect, in a very important event, I should say, in German history. Note that the minister for ex-Pelé is none other than Theodor Oberländer of the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, a former SS man, a liaison officer between the Gehlen organization and the Vlasov Liberation Army that we've looked at, and an individual who was also very close to Gerhard Frey of the Deutsche National Zeitung und Soldatenzeitung, to which Edwin Walker had communicated the information that Lee Oswald had fired at him. Oberländer also a member of the international, the head at one point, of the International Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture, a German-based intelligence network whose Texas representative was none other than Nelson Bunker Hunt. And pay attention here, too, to the fact that we're going to hear about liberation. Okay, now we've already taken a look at the evolution of liberation from a Third Reich psychological and political warfare technique into a major American technique of the same type, and finally its evolution into a major domestic political force here in the United States as a result of the action of the Crusade for Freedom and the CIA. And we're going to take a look. Bear in mind, too, that the liberation became a major theme of the Republican campaign, both at the presidential and congressional and senatorial levels in 1952. What we're going to look at is what liberation meant in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany in that same time period. First, we're going to take a look at liberation as espoused by the Nazi Party in exile in Madrid. We're going to go into that at greater length. And then we're going to see identical policies being espoused by the Chancellor of Germany, the aforementioned Konrad Adenauer, the Chancellor of the, quote, new, unquote, Germany. So we're going to take a look at the policies, first of all, being espoused by the Nazi Party in exile in Madrid, Spain, and then the same policy of, quote, liberation, unquote, being espoused by Chancellor Adenauer and his ministers. So we're going to proceed now with Radio Free America number two.
Only were key Nazis put into the government, but the government policies of West Germany have, to a large extent, assumed many aspects of Nazi foreign policy. In other words, we don't just have the people in there, we have them executing, or at least attempting to execute, some of the same kinds of policies as we saw under Hitler. Now, in this section, the next section, again, from T.H. Tetten's The New German and the Old Nazis, we're going to see a very interesting use of the German nationals who were basically expelled from the previously Nazi-dominated eastern territories, Poland, Czechoslovakia, the Soviet Union, and so forth. They were then, those people who were actually ethnic Germans were sent back to Germany after World War II. Now, these ethnic Germans were used by the West German government as a source of agitation for eastern expansion of the German Republic. Sound familiar? Well, we're going to get into this right now. Again, returning to the New Germany and the Old Nazis. Large groups of Sudeten Germans and Volksdeutsche in Poland played a vital role in the Hitler Holocaust. They filled the ranks of the SS, and they fought fanatically to Germanize the Slavic lands. It was in the light of this record that the Allies decided at Yalta and Potsdam to set the Oder-Neisse line as a final stop to Germany's century-old Drang nach Osten, push to the east. Most Nazis had fled, and the rest of the plotters were sent home in order to end all further conspiracies. What else could the Allies have done? Had not the cry Heim ins Reich vibrated throughout Europe in the heyday of National Socialism? When in 1945, fate caught up with the Sudeten Germans and the Volksdeutsche, they were simply sent, quote, home to Germany, unquote. Soon after the end of World War II, the Germans started to use the ex-Pelé question as a lever for a revision of the Yalta and Potsdam decision. Under the Allied occupation statute, the refugees were not permitted to organize. Nevertheless, they appeared in public as early as 1949 with a highly effective apparatus for mass propaganda. The refugee newspapers, among them the Volksbote in Munich and Die Stimme der Vertriebenen in Hamburg, began to agitate openly. There is little doubt that the ex-Pelés played an important part in the calculations of Dr. Naumann and his associates in Madrid. Interrupting here, Dr. Naumann was the one of Joseph Goebbels' top propaganda officials and designated by Goebbels as his propaganda successor should he pass on for the Third Reich. He was arrested by the British in 1953 for plotting with a bunch of other ex-Nazis to restore Nazism in Germany. Turning again to the book, The New Germany and the Old Nazis by T.H. Tetten's. There is little doubt that the Expellés played an important part in the calculations of Dr. Naumann and his associates in Madrid. A secret circular letter issued in 1950 by the Nazi headquarters in Madrid stated, "The millions of Expellés must be regarded as a valuable trump card in our policy toward the restoration of German power. The expulsion of 10 million German racial comrades was a blessing for the Reich. The Expellés strengthened the biological substance of our race, and from the beginning, they became a valuable asset to our propaganda. The Expellés, discontented with their fate, infused a strong political dynamism in our demands. Very soon, we were able to drown out the noisy propaganda about German crimes," unquote, with our counter-accusation about the heinous misdeeds committed against 10 million German racial comrades. The distress of the refugees has created a common political ground among all Germans, regardless of political affiliation. The demand for the restitution of the stolen German territories keeps our political agitation alive. The militant elements among the refugees are working according to the best traditions of National Socialism, whereas the broad masses among the Expellés are kept close together in well-disciplined homeland organizations. The expulsion of millions of our racial comrades provides us with a heaven-sent opportunity to exacerbate the problem of the bleeding border and to hammer constantly for its revision. For years, there has been a tremendous propaganda drive to bring the more than 10 million refugees back to their homelands," unquote. This campaign has been carried on with the full support of the Adenauer government. Bonn has nourished the hope among the Germans that through a policy of strength, unquote, the lost territories in the East can be recovered. It was precisely this view which motivated the Adenauer government to pursue a policy of diplomatic non-recognition toward all East European states. In 1952 and 1953, Dr. Adenauer and his assistants openly advocated a program of liberation. The day after his election victory in 1953, the Chancellor, in a fiery speech in Bonn, demanded the Befreiung of the territories in the East, quote, "But instead of reunification, let us talk rather of liberation, Befreiung, the liberation of our brethren in slavery in the East. That is our aim, and that we shall achieve, but only with outside help."
Continuing on, right where Dave left off. A year before that, at a press interview in Washington, the Chancellor's principal diplomatic assistant, State Secretary Walter Hallstein, defined the area to be liberated as reaching up to the Ural Mountains. At that time, the Germans dreamed of a third power block between America and the Soviet bloc of 550 million people, including a Slavic population of more than 200 million now living within the Soviet bloc. Let me just cut in here for a moment. Now, when they say year before that, they're talking about in 1952, okay? This is fully 7 years after World War II has ended, several years after democracy has been reinstalled in West Germany, et cetera, et cetera. The Germans are dreaming of an area up to the Soviet Ural Mountains as being now a possession of Germany and a power block of 550 million people under direct German control, including Slavs to the tune of 200 million people. The liberation concept had been freely and frequently discussed at that time in the Rheinische Merkur. One of the Chancellor's staunchest supporters, Dr. Robert Ingram, admonished the German politicians to discard the sterile concept of reunification and substitute for it a dynamic program of liberation. Quote, "The task is not reunification, but the liberation of all that has been lost," stated Dr. Ingram in a lead article. There remained little doubt that Bonn's liberation program envisioned the use of all possible means. It was Hitler's Drang nach Osten, drive to the East, all over again. Among the cities pinpointed for liberation by Dr. Ingram were Warsaw, Prague, and Vienna. The unrestrained liberation propaganda of the early 50s created such unease in diplomatic quarters at Paris and London that Dr. Adenauer was soon compelled to renounce military force as a means to recover the lost territories. Since then, the new formula in the Chancellor's statements concerning reunification and revision of the Oder-Neisse Line has become, quote, "in peace and freedom." However, apart from the Chancellor's official position, there is a very different cast to the speeches by other cabinet members before the huge refugee rallies.